My name's Sophie Hannah, and in this episode, I love that me and Luanda got down to it again, disagreeing about influencer pay gap and race. So check out and listen for that moment. Hope you enjoy today's episode of Ethnically Speaking.
I'm kind of here for post-nups because maybe in the beginning, but honestly, I'm telling you, because maybe in the prenup, before, we were probably not even thinking about prenup. We were just... things were going well. Everything was kiki fine. But maybe in our marriage, we had a bit of a breakdown and now we're trying to come back together and work it out. In that circumstance, I would have a post-nup. The reason why I put a post-nup in place is because I have seen what you are like when you don't get your way. And I don't like that. So now that we're getting back together, if there is any chance that we might get a divorce again, I'm going to put a post-nup in place to protect now what is in this union.
Hey Lisa, so that's why is going to sign that? What?
Yasmin.
I'm Sophie Hannah.
Hi, I'm Anissa, and welcome to episode 17 of Ethnically Speaking. We are three fabulously smart, opinionated, curious, and highly melanated women representing the UK, and we're here to discuss everything and anything affecting our communities, from pop culture to current affairs and everything in between. Nothing is off limits, and we always keep it 100. So forget tiptoeing around topics and technically speaking, because today we are ethnically speaking. Sophie, let's go.
Okay, so I wanted to talk to you today about Keira Bell, who was a 23-year-old woman who was treated with hormone blockers to prevent the onset of puberty as a teenager, and she is now launching a legal battle against the NHS because she's saying she should have been told to wait. Now, at the age of 15, Keira began to identify as a boy. She says that the specialised child gender clinic in London's Tavistock Centre steered her towards taking medication that resulted in her receiving hormone blockers after roughly 3 sessions. Now, an internal review that was conducted at the Tavistock Centre in 2005 found that clinicians felt that they had been put under pressure to refer patients to gender transitioning pathways much too quickly. And then a further investigation that happened last year showed that clinicians also had concerns about child protection, safeguarding, but they said that these concerns were just shut down. Now, after 8 years, and after undergoing surgery, Keira is detransitioning and she is now again identifying as a woman. So my question to you ladies is, do you think that children should be given hormone blockers? And do you think that a child can truly give informed consent about taking treatment that delays puberty and puts them on the path to start transitioning?
I hope that what happened to Keira doesn't happen again to any child ever. Yeah. I mean, you just said, Sophie, she had 3 sessions. 3.
Roughly. And for anyone roughly that does, 3 yeah. sessions. That's the
And also, in terms of time, though, the sessions were roughly an hour each. That is not enough. That is just not enough.
Not.
But at the same time, another thing that I don't want to happen is for people to use this very public story to discredit trans children and their gender identity, because I do believe that every person deserves to have their gender identity recognized and respected, no matter what their age is. For me, allowing a child to express their gender identity is a no-brainer, but allowing a child to permanently change their prepubescent body, that requires, you know, a couple more layers of thought. And I don't even say that lightly, because I know that these transitions have saved lives. I know that these transitions have prevented so much suicide. And I know that in terms of statistics, the children who regret their transitions are less than 1%. So I'm not, you know, unaware of all of those things. I do just think that we need to have a different alternative. And I think that in terms of our society, we can do this in the long term, but in terms of the children's households, this needs to be done immediately. And I really believe that we need to just deconstruct gender, because we have gendered skill sets and personality traits, and we have gendered jobs. We need to allow people to like whatever clothes that they like and whatever colors that they like, but we have gendered clothes and colors as well. We have related, you know, femininity purely to womanhood and masculinity purely to manhood. And these are the kind of things that mess with, like, say, maybe like a young girl who doesn't feel in the slightest bit feminine might feel like she is not allowed to identify as a woman. And Kira said herself that, you know, she, of course, she doesn't know what could have happened, but she believes that if she was more accepted by society, if she was allowed to be who she was back then she probably wouldn't have gone down this path. And so, yeah, like I said, as a society, but also for the children in the household, because I know that they go through therapy, they need to also do that with the family as a whole, I think.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with, I guess, most parts of what you're saying, Luanda. I think there definitely has to be layers when you start to think about children making permanent decisions over their lives. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's almost like I feel almost not well-versed enough to even really have a valuable contribution, because I'm not somebody who has struggled with my gender identity. I'm not raising a child, and I'm not raising a child who is also struggling with their gender identity. So I can't say what's right for a child to do. Like, do you know what I mean? And when I was reading the Kira Bell story, there was another woman in the lawsuit, but they were referring to her as Mum A. And she was talking about how she just, the basis of it was just like this decision was happening and she wasn't sure if this was the right decision for her child, but it was almost a decision for her that she couldn't make, basically. Like, it was the child and the doctors and the medical profession, institute, whatever they're called. There we go, professionals. I was like, institution, body. It was almost like she was almost left out of it. And it's so difficult because for me, I feel like everybody should live their truth. But then I say that, but I, with children, I feel like they have to live their truth, but under stewardship, if that makes any sense. So yeah, I would never encourage a child to make a permanent decision as a child. I just wouldn't. I think when they're, I think six, for me personally, 16, I feel like is of age when you're stepping into young adulthood to start to make decisions for yourself. But under 16, I wouldn't encourage a young child. I wouldn't encourage anybody under 16 to make any permanent decision. And I'm not just talking specifically about gender reassignment, but it could be about getting a tattoo or having a kid or whatever it is. I would just tell them not to make that decision so young, because life experience and knowledge and things, it's you don't get that all when you're young. And so it's a pretty tough. So I think if you're 16 and over, then if you would like to go on the blockers and things like that, then that's what you should do. That's your prerogative. But I think under 16, it has to be considered. I think a lot more consideration, a lot more layers needs to go into it. A lot more than three sessions needs to go into it if you're making a permanent decision when you're that young.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, guys, I'm kind of on the same page as you, but I'd probably say that I still think that 16 is also too young.
I was going to say the same thing.
Really?
And I think,
if
I really want to go into this, so I think we need to be very clear about the various stages. So it's the Gender Identity Development Service. So that's called GIDS. That's the one that I think that Kira is the one that's saying that is at fault here. And they have various stages. So the first stage is the assessment, where they would get you in and talk to you. Then they would say that it's reversible treatment, which is the hormone blockers. So to be very clear, the hormone blockers are really just prevent puberty. They don't really make any changes. They kind of stop puberty happening. And hormone blockers are also given to people who might be experiencing puberty too early. So it's not just for people who are transitioning. Now, they're trying to say there are some side effects to it that they don't really know the long-term side effects yet. They don't know how it affects the brain. They don't know how it affects you psychologically, but they say generally everything's reversible. Once you've stopped taking it, puberty should happen as normal if you decide to change your mind. Then they have ones that are like partially irreversible, and those now become the cross-sex hormones, and you can only start taking those from a minimum age of 16 after you've been on the hormone blockers for 12 months, and those will make you develop breast tissue, or they will break your voice, and those can't be reversed. If you grow the breast tissue and your voice breaks, it's irreversible. And then they're talking about a permanent transition, whereas if you have gender reassignment surgery for your genitalia. In terms of the hormone blockers, I think for me, because we don't really know what the long-term effects are, that's why I'd be scared to give it to my child. And I think it's a very fine line, because if my child had body dysmorphia, which I fully believe is a real thing, and they had serious stress and depression and problems fitting into like their social circles at school because they just didn't really feel like they fitted in with their body, then I would want them to have some intensive counseling so we could really explore that before they made a decision that was permanent. And I think for me, I would be comfortable with them starting something at 18, because I'm like, you're an adult. You're at the minimum age of an adult, but you're an adult, because there are other decisions for me that we wouldn't allow children to make. We're not going to allow a child to say that they don't want to go to school because they don't think it's the best thing for them and they're 11 or 12. We're not going to say they're going to decide to eat whatever they want to eat because they know best and they know themselves best. We were saying just on last week's episode, Luanda said, I wouldn't date guys that I dated 2 years ago. Me too. Like, there's guys that I dated 5, 6 years ago that I wouldn't date again. But then we want a child who's like 9 or 10 to make a decision about starting
that affects the rest of their life.
That affects their life, and we don't know the long-term effects. I'm like, a child for me cannot make that decision. They can have the feelings, but I'm like, I can't, as a parent, I have to step in and make some of these decisions until you're old enough. And then when you're at 18, then it's your decision, and hopefully we've instilled you. But even then, as an 18-year-old, even then, we would say there's decisions that we made at 18, and I would hate to think if I made a decision for myself at 18 that I would have to carry on for the rest of my life, because I'd have been like, looking now at 33, it probably would have been the wrong decision. It probably would have been the wrong
decision. Yeah. I think also just what you said about hormone blockers, Sophie, just for anyone that doesn't know, what they say about them is that they don't know the long-term effects that it has on a developing brain. Okay, and agree with you in terms of, because you said you don't know the long-term effects that it has on a developing brain, why are we giving this to developing people? It doesn't make sense to me. And it's frustrating, because I kind of feel like on this topic, I feel like I have some sort of like cognitive dissonance when I want to, like I said, I believe that everyone's gender identity should be respected. And if I had a child who identified with a gender that was opposite to their sex, that allow them to live in that truth. But I don't think that I would allow them to do anything permanent before the age of 18. Yeah. And that makes me question, you know, how much do I then respect the identity if I'm not allowing you to do anything permanent towards it? Because I wouldn't question for a second, you know, if you're telling me that you're a woman, I'll treat you as a woman. If you're telling me you're non-binary, that's fine. It doesn't matter. But then if you're saying that I want to permanently change my body, I'm not on board. In terms of Kira's case, though, I do want to say, because Anissa, you were like, oh, this happened after like 3 sessions, like we've all said. But her case is rare, and not just in terms of the fact that she regrets it, but in terms of the process, this doesn't happen to most of the kids that are in that situation. There is a really, really long process where they look at your family life and your school life, and if you're going to harm yourself, and you have ongoing therapy. And even the hormone blockers is a part of making sure that these kids make the right decisions, because they will be asked, we can pause this so you have more time to think, so that they don't rush into these decisions. And I think the reason why this happened to Kira is because the number of children who are experiencing gender dysphoria is rising. And I think, not that, actually, let me rephrase that, because I believe that they're more comfortable talking about it now. Like, I don't think it's a new thing. It's a new thing that's being openly talked about, and that's changing. And so there was a doctor who worked for GIDS and said in 2005 they were experiencing referrals in the tens per year, but by 2015 they were experiencing referrals in the thousands. And so I feel like sometimes the more something expands, the more opportunity there is for mishaps. The only issue is with something as serious and as permanent as gender reassignment, I don't think there's room for mistakes
because we are talking specifically about the hormone blockers, because gender reassignment is not something that you could have under the age of 18. Like, that would be something that they would have to make as a consent.
But you know how you just said that with the hormone blockers, that's reversible, but then you go to the cross-sex hormones, which isn't. And that starts at 16, so they're saying the kids that have done that process, you know, the regret is like less than 1%, and most of them have had like a thorough process because, you know, I've seen interviews of adults who went through that situation. They were like, they asked me so many times, we did all this therapy, we did this, this and that. So that's what I mean by when I say her case is rare. But for me, as soon as you're doing something that's irreversible, that is reassignment, because you're
I think it's tough as well, because one of the nurses who used to work at GIDS, as far as I'm aware, she was saying she thought that starting the hormone blockers at 16 was too young.
Yeah.
But now we're giving them to 10-year-olds. There's 10-year-olds who are taking it. 10-year-olds, 9-year-olds. And then by the time they get to 16, they're doing something that is going to break their voice irreversibly. And I think that just really concerns me. But I think on the flip side as well, I don't know if you guys have heard of Nikki Tutorials. She's a makeup vlogger. Nikki DeJager. So she came out, I think, at the beginning of last year, revealing that she's actually trans. And she passes, which means that you wouldn't really know that she was born in the body with male genitalia. And she started the hormone blockers before 14, then she started the cross-sex ones, and then she said she fully transitioned by the age of 19. And the fact that she was able, this is why it makes it so difficult for me, is because the fact that she transitioned or began the transitioning process so early means that she probably looks more like the identity that she identifies with, because she didn't go through puberty, because it was paused. Whereas if you have a man who is, well, born with male genitalia but feels like they identify as a woman and they go through the puberty process and they don't have any blockers, you are not really going to be able to wind back the physical appearance the way you would if they'd started it before. So, and the people who present as the genitalia that they were born with rather than the one that they now identify with, if they don't match how they feel and how they look, they're going to get more abuse. They're in more danger.
It's so true.
And there's this big thing about passing. So it's kind of like, and this is what made it so difficult, because I'm like, I would want to protect my child from making a lifelong decision and to say, make it when you're an adult. But what about by the time they've gotten to an adult, they're like, now I look like a woman and my breasts have developed and all of this stuff might not have happened if you'd have just allowed me to take the hormone blockers, and now I'm going to have maybe surgeries that I didn't need to have if you'd just taken me seriously when I'd have said it when I was younger. And I think it's just so difficult as an adult in general to know, to make a decision that's best for children in general. Every parent that I've known has like, you do the best you can. You make the best decision that you can. So
I agreed with you and said it was so tough, because it's like, as a parent, where do you step in? Like, if your child is telling you, this is how I feel, this is me, you want to respect that, you know, nourish that and not stifle that, so they're, you know, so they don't feel lost or resent you or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, you have to almost be an adult and be like, but you're still a child going through childhood, so I need to have some level of control here. And so that's why I said earlier on, it's so difficult for me to even have a valuable contribution to this discussion, because this isn't something I've experienced, so I can't say for sure what's the best way to handle it. I think everyone, as you said, Sophie, you just have to do the best you can and hope that's what it is. But that's why I kind of said 16 as well, for younger, because I know at 16 you probably wouldn't want to make any lifelong decision, but 16, you know, you start to step into your young adulthood, you start trying to make more balanced decisions, and maybe at 16.
I agree with you to a certain extent, because obviously in the UK that is the age to have sex is 16.
Yeah,
but and you can get married with your parents' consent.
You can, but how many people actually look back at having sex on 16 and were like, that was completely the right decision?
But for me, I'd say say 16. That was just
right. Okay. That's okay. Interesting because I do believe that we should lower the voting age to 16, and I've always believed that. And I believe that since I was 16.
You can make decisions to break your voice or to grow breast tissue that wasn't there by having hormone breakers, but you can't vote. It's just
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't really make sense to me. But like we said, we're not experts on this subject. And anyone who is transitioning, we completely respect your decision and your right and your ability to affirm your identity. But I wanted to talk to you ladies about another transition that is happening in someone's life. And I'm talking about rapper, producer and entrepreneur Dr. Dre, who is going through a divorce at the moment after 24 years of marriage to Nicole Young. Now, they both signed prenuptial agreements before they got into the marriage, but Nicole is now saying that she was forced to sign it under duress. Nicole has been asking for just under $2 million in spousal support, saying that she needs to be kept in the lifestyle that she became accustomed to when she was married, and claiming that she actually influenced her husband's success. Dr. Dre has said that the amount she's asking for is absurd, that he is still paying for her financial expenses, and that he really wants the dissolution of their marriage to be amicable. A judge has actually ruled on this and said that she's not entitled to the money that she's asking for, but they're still hashing it out and they're going to go to court early next year. But what I wanted to ask you ladies is, would you ever sign a prenuptial agreement? And when it comes to a divorce, do you think it's reasonable for someone to maintain the lifestyle that they had during the marriage? Or do you think everyone should leave the marriage with what they came in it with?
Well, with prenups, I think if I was talking generally to anyone, I'd say sign it if it makes sense to you. Personally, for me, would I sign a prenup? Yeah, okay. If it makes sense, then why wouldn't I? I'm not bothered by it too much. I know some people are personally offended by it, but I'm not really personally offended by it. If you feel like you have things that you would like to protect, then by all means go ahead and do that. And if I felt like there are things that I want to protect, I'd go ahead and do that. But I know prenups are also used not to just protect assets, but also how you would divide your assets, so that if you did get divorced, the process would be a little bit easier. You wouldn't have to do so much litigation. So I'd be like, okay, cool, yeah, maybe if the prenup makes sense, I would do a prenup. Now, if I was thinking about divorce, this is where I'm a little bit tougher, because I just think I have a different mindset. If I had children with you, then yes, I would expect a certain amount of money for me to be able to look after these children and have the same kind of or similar lifestyle that we had. If I didn't have children with you, then I don't really want anything, and I'm not really expecting anything, okay, whether prenup or not prenup, just because I've said it a few times, but I'm an able-bodied person. I can get up and go get a job and go work. If, for example, I know with Nicole, what she's saying in this situation, she did help to contribute to his success. I understand, like, as a marriage, things are a partnership, and so you do things to help each other. But, like, I don't know. I'm not married and not looking into marriage late and soon. But I don't know if I would ever give up so much of myself and my own dreams to make somebody else's dreams come true, so that if things don't work out, I'm kind of waiting for your dreams to pay me to just fund my life. Like, for me, it just wouldn't work like that. Like, it would.
What I'm gonna ask is, you're saying that you would want to just kind of leave and be like, no problem, keep your money. But what about, like, Nicole, if your lifestyle has drastically increased and without him you can't afford to do the things, in fact anything, that you really did before? Like, would you still be like, I don't want anything?
Yes, you have to go out and get that money, honey. You have to do the thing about money and that kind of lifestyle is it is fleeting, and it's nothing that you can take with you into the afterlife. You can sit there and say, you know what? I had a good ride for 24 years. I'm in a new phase of my life, and let me do something that feels happier to me and something that I can do for my own. That's how I would personally see it. So as I said, I have a bit of a tougher stance on that. I don't expect anything from anybody at any point. So I feel that.
Okay. I feel that, Anissa. I'm signing a prenup. Happily, I will sign a prenup. And I know that a lot of people say, like, oh, if you're in love, you don't need one and all of that shenanigans. But if you are getting married to someone, if you're getting married to someone, you should be comfortable with them completely, to the point where you're able to discuss and sign prenups as well. I think that, you know, once, like, whilst we're married, what's mine is yours. But when we get divorced, what's mine is mine, actually. And and like Anissa, if I'm the person in the relationship that earns less, then I'm just going to have to take that L. Because I, again, like, I don't want to stay with someone for a lifestyle. I only want to stay with someone for love. And I think that marriages should be set up in a way that if a couple separates, the only thing they're going to lose is each other. Because I know that there are so many relationships, so many marriages that are unhappy, but they stay like that because they don't want a messy divorce. And I've seen so many, read about, haven't seen them, haven't met them, read about so many wealthy people. Yeah, I've lived vicariously through all these rich people.
Yeah.
That have and end up having messy divorces because this wasn't, not to say that, because I guess a lot of people, the connotations that lie with it is that a lot of people think that if you have a prenup, you're planning for divorce. And yeah, it's really not that. It's just something that makes sense. And I think even if you're not as rich as Dr. Dre, when looking at his finances, even if she was to get $2 million a month, like, he could afford it. Not that she should get it, but he could afford it if she did. Even if you're not, even if you don't have a bank like Dr. Dre, as a normal person, you should still get a prenup, I think. I think everyone should have one.
You know, I wasn't really here for prenups, to be honest. I just,
you're the married person, so teach us, please.
Honestly.
No, the thing is, I'm different from everybody. You guys, what you're saying is what works for you. I guess for me, when I was first thinking about it, I'm just like, I ain't signing no prenup. Like, I don't have access to the money. I was in the marriage, and 100%, even if you're working at home and you're a housewife, you know, you are supporting them. You are there when they're going to do their dreams. Like, if your dream is to be a housewife and support your husband and raise kids, valid dream. But you're also supporting the household and the guy. And I hate when it comes down to finances and then it's kind of like, well, he made all the money. And I'm just like, he didn't make it by himself. He didn't come home to himself when things weren't going right. He spoke to somebody about it. Like, there was someone there supporting. And I guess for me with prenups, I did marriage counseling before I got married because at my, like, my faith, they won't marry you unless you have marriage counseling. And one of the things we have to talk about is money, because they're saying it's such, it makes such a big, not a big difference, but it affects your marriage very much dramatically, how you both view money. And they're kind of like, you have to look at it as our money. Like, you can't think of it as my money, your money. Like, it has to be ours because you're now trying to become one.
Yeah, so ours, whilst we're married.
Well, this is, but isn't there, the marriage isn't there ways to get divorced and he was just like, well, actually, it was all mine. But I would like to think, and I know I'm being naive, that once you go through the divorce, hopefully you want to go through it amicably and you want to do it with respect. But most marriages don't end like that. And I think when no, go ahead, my love.
I think in terms of, like, amicable divorces, I think it speaks a lot to what the marriage was whilst it's there. So I don't think it's not going to be naive if that's going to be your truth. If your marriage is healthy and there's a certain level of respect there, you want to carry that respect even, like, onto the divorce and onto the lawyers, even if you're separating. Like, that's, I think respect is not something that should go away. And I personally would like to know more, because I understand what you're saying in terms of, like, you're supporting each other because you're in a partnership. I would like to know more about what she says in terms of how she's responsible for a lot of his success or how she helped. There's no articles that detail that. All of the articles say
she wants £10,000 for laundry, she wants £900,000 for entertainment.
I did see an article that said she was the one that named
she's talking broadly, Anissa. She's not just going to be like, you know, that one
this is what I'm saying is the issue. We start to say, tell me exactly how you contribute. I'm just like, being married is a partnership. That is the contribution. Being the support, like, if you're in a couple, it should be one where you're able to lean on each other. Maybe sometimes you talk about work, but you help them, you talk to them, and maybe you're not directly involved in the finances, but you have a partnership to come home to. And
in theory, correct, but, like, we're talking about legality. Like, that's not going to, that argument is not going to stand in court.
I'm not going to lie, Sophie. The reason why I can't agree with all of what you're saying is because, yes, you might have been there to talk to me and support me and come home and clean the house and everything like that, but when I was out in the streets, we weren't in the streets together. Because if I'm thinking about me at work now, you're not with me in my 9-to-5 making the decision. So you're really not really directly affecting my work or the success I have at work.
But are you talking about, pre money made pre divorce? Because with Nicole, like, I'm not saying I agree with her, and I think the 2 million is absurd. I'm not going to lie. And if it's 900,000 for entertainment, I'm like, maybe that needs to come down.
I saw that. I was like, how are you?
I'm just like, that's a lot of money. We don't
know what that means.
I don't know.
Can we get that in writing?
my thing is, like, the majority of his money was made in the marriage. So things, yeah. And I think that's the point where, looking into this topic, I thought, do you know what? Maybe I would sign a prenup after what I've read. Because they're saying a prenup is really trying to make good, wise decisions and fair decisions at a time of love. Because it was just like, when the marriage breaks down, a lot of the time it's broken down acrimoniously. But if you've already made the prenup at a time when things were good, you're more likely to be fair. And I thought, thinking about it, like, if I ran a business, let's say for a wellness business in yoga, and then my husband, when we get divorced, he's like, I want half of it. And I'm just like, you don't teach any of the classes. And this so I would be into a prenup if it was talking about, you know, maybe I would give you a cut of the business, but not ownership. Because obviously, in some places in the UK or in some places in America, they literally divide it 50-50. Everything goes
like
into
California,
the pot.
Everything
goes 50-50. And if it's a business that you don't really have any say-so in terms of from the board, and you're not really that interested in it, then I would be like, in the prenup, let's sign something to say that I can give you a percentage, but I'm not going to give you a share in the business, because it's just not fair. Or for some things like family inheritance. So, like, let's say, for example, you broke up and then someone died and left you money. They're like, yeah, I get 50% of that as well. Like, I think certain things should be protected. So I'm kind of leaning into, but because me and my husband came in at the same level, I'm like, bro, if you make peas, I'm taking 50%.
But you know what? Some couples are doing that. They're actually doing post-nups. I don't know if you guys have heard this.
So
after they're getting married,
I'm
they're putting
that.
Together agreements.
You're not getting money and trying to stifle me out. No.
I get it.
No. But I'm kind of here for post-nups, because maybe in the beginning, but honestly, I'm telling you, because maybe in the prenup, before, we were probably not even thinking about prenup. We were just, things were going well. Everything was key fine. But maybe in our marriage, we had a bit of a breakdown, and now we're trying to come back together and work it out. In that circumstance, I would have a post-nup. The reason why I put a post-nup in place is because I have seen what you are like when you don't get your way, and I don't like that. So now that we're getting back together, if there is any chance that we might get a divorce again, I'm going to put a post-nup in place to protect now what is in this union.
And Lisa, what fool is going to sign that?
I don't know how much TV that you guys watch, but there's a TV show that I watch, and there's a couple.
What's it called?
Real Housewives of Potomac. Okay, anyway, there's a young wife, her name's Ashley. She's been married to her husband for 5 years, right? And she actually decided to get a post-nup. They just had a baby, but she decided to get a post-nup after the baby, because before the baby, he had an indiscretion and she just didn't feel. He's very, very wealthy. She was a younger girl. Basically, he's like 50. She was 26 when they got married. She was working in a bar. He's this big real estate developer. Anyway, they've been married for 5 years now. They have a baby. He's had an indiscretion while she was pregnant. After she had the baby, she got back together with him and everything like that. But she said she's only going to feel comfortable now if there is an agreement in place to protect her and her son, and that she would get what was right for her, or blah blah blah. And I thought, yeah, Ashley, I'd definitely do a post now. And he signed it.
See, that's not a bad idea, I don't think. And also, if you don't sort yourself out in terms of prenups or postnups, you could also be left with like people's debt. And I think, you know, this is why I said, it doesn't matter what your financial situation is. We should all sort ourselves out, because they're saying, in terms of our generation, in terms of millennials, you could be left, if you divorce, you could be paying back your ex-husband's student loan Don't let it happen.
Oh my gosh.
Don't let it happen.
In the UK.
I think this is the thing. Again, when I did my marriage counseling, they were like, if there's debt, it's your debt in the marriage. Like, you can't be thinking that's your debt. That's in, my
but
debt.
This is what I'm saying, Sophie. We need to differentiate the marriage and the separation. When I'm in the marriage, like, I am all in. Like I said, what's mine is yours. What's yours is mine. Like, debt, income, all of it. Let's have a joint account and I'll have a one on the side. Like, it's all ours. Oh, it's ours, God, and it's our families. Guys. But, like, if we're separating, we're separating assets also.
Well, please, guys, do not marry any man that has debt. Please do not do that.
Do you know what? If it's student loan, which is
everyone has student loan, it's not really a big deal. Do you know what I mean? But if he's owing the banks some serious money or the business, please do not get married. Please.
Yeah. Well, this is another thing. This is another thing I was going to say to Anissa's point, because you talked about, you know, being in a marriage and separating and then having a postnup. Well, sometimes the reason for people separating can be money issues. And so sometimes you can say to this partner, you know, I don't trust the way that you're spending, and you already destroyed our family once before. Mm. If you're coming back to this, you're coming back for me, but know that I'm not leaving with your mess. Like, we'll sign this postnup, and I know you're serious about working on this relationship, but it's just us. Like, we're not involving all of the debt or gambling or whatever it is, you know.
And I think that's the thing that I liked about the idea of a prenup, is that in order to get a prenup, you have to declare everything that you have, all your assets, all your debt. They want everything, so people know financially exactly what they're getting into. And I like the idea of it, because but I don't like the idea that someone will be holding that back from me. Like, hopefully you've spent enough time together that you can see how they spend money. Because how people spend money is very clear after a short amount of time. Every time you go out and they don't want to buy you two drinks, or they're so lavish and every time they come out, it's a different credit card. You're going to start to clock onto signs, pay attention to them. But for me, prenups, if I probably went into my marriage with more money, maybe I'd think about it to protect, like, family inheritance. But in general, no, we're splitting that.
Sophie said, I'm coming for half. What's that Kanye West line? When she leave your ass, she gonna leave with half. That? Oh, gold digger. Yeah.
I'm not fixed on the prenup thing. I could go either way. Like, if I decide, I want a prenup, I'll do one. If the person I'm with wants me to sign a prenup, then I will. But I'm not like, I can get married without a prenup. I can get married with a prenup. I'm not fixed to anything.
I think since I'm, like, on the fence about marriage already, we're getting a prenup.
I just said, no way.
So we've reached the halfway point of our episode. If you're watching on YouTube, don't forget to subscribe and give this video a thumbs up. So far, we have talked about whether or not children can make informed consent when it comes to gender reassignment treatment. And we have also talked about whether or not we'd get a prenup after Dr. Dre's situation is leaving him with a little bit of a gap in his pocket. Now I want to talk about influencer pay gaps. The Instagram account at Influencer Pay Gap has exposed that Black and Brown influencers are being paid a lot less than white influencers. Also, in addition to that, an LGBT+ influencer was paid £12,000 less, and an influencer with a disability was asked to create content for no fee at all. The Creative Union is becoming the UK's first collective body to represent digital content creators and influencers. So I wanted to ask you, do you think unionisation will solve the influencer pay gap problem? And do you think it will be beneficial for Black influencers to have their separate union as well?
So I don't know if forming a union is going to solve the problem, but I think it will definitely help and make necessary changes.
Right.
Unions, when they're independent, as they should be, independent and really there for the rights of the people that they represent, like, really help, because a lot of people don't know what their rights are. And companies, brands, industries will take advantage of you if you don't know what you should know if you don't know your rights, if you don't know what's legal. And trade unions are usually there to just really help people get what it is that they deserve and not be taken advantage of. And I definitely think that's needed in the influencer world, because let's be very clear, like, I don't blame brands all the way, because influencing is a very new industry. Like, it's cropped up in the past, what, 20 years, which might seem long, but in terms of like the car industry and the engineering industry, and like, it's a very, very new market. So there isn't a lot of regulation going on. So I can understand where it's difficult to know how to charge, but where industry, when, where brands do get into trouble is because they're taking advantage of it now. So I think someone needs to definitely come in like a union and make it fair for people across the board.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree with most of what you said, Sophie. I don't think the union is going to completely solve the problem, but I think it will be able to drive some sort of necessary change. So I definitely agree that I think influencers should get a union and put a union together. I know obviously there's, I can't remember that lady's name, but she's obviously putting work together to get the first UK kind of create digital creators union. Because union... influencers for me are kind of like, well, they are self-employed people. Yeah. And usually when you're a bit like, when you're like a one-man band, if somebody is doing you a disservice or if you're having an issue business, it's kind of hard when it's just you to kind of fight a big corporation or a big brand. And very much like what you were saying, Sophie, it is a new industry. So some influencers may not know. And I think this is what that Instagram did very well. It kind of filled in all the blanks for everybody, because some influencers may not know what is the standard of what I should be getting. What should I be making this video? And I think for a lot of brands as well, especially probably not now, but definitely a lot in the beginning, they probably didn't even know how much should I actually pay this influencer? What does their outreach like? It's all very new territory, and I think a union would work perfectly in this situation, because the brand obviously has their whole team and legal team or whoever to represent them, and a union will be the person that will fight for the influencer and fight for them. So definitely, do I think there needs to be a specific one for Black creators? I'm kind of on the fence about that, because I think anytime there's something that's focusing on your one specific issue and is only focusing on that and giving all the energy to it, then I'm always here for it, because that means they've got one clear focus and that's what they're aiming to achieve.
I get that.
But if there was one that just encompassed all digital creators, but then, you know, really paid attention to the needs of Black creators, but they, and they did it well, I wouldn't be opposed to that. Just as long as someone's fighting the fight for the people.
Yeah. So I understand what you both are saying in terms of the influencer profession being very new, but that's not actually what the issue is that is being raised. Because of course there's going to be companies that don't really know as much as we don't know, because there's no transparency in salary. But what the conversation about, what the conversation is about is pay gap. Because there was a Black influencer who was asked to collaborate with a company, and that same company accidentally sent her a message that was meant for a white influencer. And in the message that they sent her for the white influencer, they were offering the white influencer money when they weren't offering that to the Black influencer. And so the Black woman went on the white woman's page and saw that the Black woman actually even had more followers. So I struggle to get my head around it, because it's clear that you are not valuing Black content creators. But if you don't value them, then why did you fix your thumbs to message them in the first place? Like, if you don't value their creativity, then just leave them alone. Why are you reaching out to them but then offering them less than you are offering other white influencers? And especially in that case, because if that girl has more followers, and the reason why influencers are valued, the reason why they have influence is because they have large followings, and if she could give you more outreach and yet you were not offering her money, we need to talk about why that is.
So what's the issue for you then? Because we're talking about trade unions and things like that. What is actually the issue for you, the way that you see it?
No, I don't understand why Black creators are not being paid the same as white creators. Like, do you see what I'm saying?
I understand, like, but you were saying that talking about the brands in terms of it being a new industry isn't really the issue. Yeah. And I'm just saying...
No. You got... Go ahead.
No, go on.
So because the way that it sounded like to me, the way what you guys were saying, it's like, okay, influence, being an influencer is new and all of those things. And yet for me, that's separate, because when you are a company and you know that you are collaborating with influencers and you have two influencers, one of them can offer you more outreach, but you're not offering this person money. And the one that can offer you less outreach, you are offering a fund and they also happen to be white. Why is that happening? That's what I need to know. That's what I'm questioning.
I think some of it is happening because people are taking in preconceived ideas into the way that they go after market. So I think brands are still thinking that if you're white, if you're able-bodied, if you're cisgendered, if you're straight sized, that's going to be more attractive because that's what we say in society. And I think that it's obviously underpinned by racism, but I think they're thinking, but this is going to be more attractive. This is going to be more sellable. But I agree that there needs to be more equality in the way that they do things. And I think that unions can help with that. But I think part of it isn't going to happen. And that's why I mentioned it being a new industry until certain regulations come in. Because when you work in a normal job, there is the Equality Act that says you cannot discriminate against someone because of their gender, their race, their culture, their marital status, their sex. You can't discriminate. But because it's a new industry, there are no regulations. So it makes it much easier to have these different pay gaps in them because they're like, well, there are no rules. We can just do it based on whatever we want, which I agree is completely wrong. But let's not get it twisted. Like, look, I'm going to tell you a very true story. And this is from a big influencer that I know. And she says, a really big female black influencer, who I'm not going to name at all, because we're going to get in trouble. But she had it written into her contract that she wouldn't work on projects if there was another black creator there. She must be the only black creator. And I was just like, what? And she was just like, Sophie, it's the truth. Her ex-manager showed me the contract and it was in there. She wouldn't work on any other projects if someone black was there. So it's not just the white brands who are trying to do it. Some people are only out for their own bag. And that's why I'm saying it's not brands have to come together. Influencers have to come together. Because if what we saw with Jeremy Tardy, who used to be on Dear White People, and he was getting underpaid by trans gays.
Yes.
I'm not sure what character he was, but he wrote on Twitter.
I can't remember his name on the show, but I know you're talking. Yes, can we go?
He was saying he was getting underpaid, and he was saying he got together with the other six other leads from Netflix on the show. And let's be clear, I watched the film of Dear White People, and there's a lot of black main characters. He's got together with six of them because they were saying a lot of the black ones were getting underpaid. So he said, if we form together, then we're going to have more power. And he said before they could even negotiate, a lot of them got bought out on separate deals and kind of left him standing. And he was still saying, I am going to walk away because you're not treating me right. So let's not get it twisted that this is just about race and all the black people are together, because they're not. Some people only care about protecting themselves. So we have to put in rules. We have to put in unions. We have to put in all of this stuff because it's just a messy situation.
Piggyback off what you're saying, Sophie. That's why, for me, I think unions in this market is so important, so we can do collective bargaining and there's not this, like, stabbing in the back, if that's what you want to call it. But I also just want to point out as well, not to, like, take anyone's side, but sometimes, even though someone could have less followers than you, their engagement can be higher, and that's why they may get a higher fee, because even though you can have a big audience, if they're not willing to pay for anything that you're selling, then it's not really worth advertising with that particular influencer. So I think engagement plays a big role in it as well. And that's why, but that's once again something that needs to be transparent. And I think the union's going to help bring transparency to that industry for the brands and for the creators. And then that way as well, it can start to foster a bit more equality. Well, because they're going to have to be equal by law, in that the union's going to have to push for fairness and equality. Sorry, my headphones keep dropping in. The union's going to have to push for fairness and equality if then they see, okay, you know what, actually our black influencers, they're not getting paid the same amount as our white influencers. So we need to change this regulation or do X, Y, Z, rather than an Instagram account has been made and people are now kind of just, we've got this information, but nothing has been done much about it. That's why I
did
the union.
Okay, so with the Instagram account, she is actually doing a lot of things. Like, I definitely agree that the union is a good start, and I agree with you in terms of transparency, Anita, because I think, you know, you don't, like we said, like we keep saying, like being an influencer, there's not really a rule book to go off of. There's not really like, oh, you should be paid this minimum or this and this and that. And there aren't things behind us to, so that we know whether or not we're being taken advantage of. And yeah, companies definitely take advantage of that as well. So I definitely think there needs to be like allies between each other, like no matter the race, because for example, there was a black influencer who went and did a modeling gig and she said, okay, you can pay me £100. And then she went there and she met a white model who was getting paid a grand.
Yeah.
But she didn't she didn't know what she could charge.
She didn't know what to ask for.
She didn't know, she didn't know how to like value it and how to value her worth and things like that. The influencer pay gap Instagram page does look at engagement and outreach and all of that stuff. Like that's the first thing that the influencers who come for help mention. And so I think it's difficult because like reading all these stories like does confuse me, but at the same time, I just think companies, are you not just making more mess for yourself by not being fair? Can't you just offer everyone a base rate and see what
people like to get away with?
Exactly. And I think that's why it's so important.
People like to get away with everything.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's so important with the influencer pay gap Instagram. I think it was started by Adewusu Adejayi. And what's so wonderful about it, because it reveals what people are earning. And it's very anti-British. Like, we don't discuss money. And that's why brands are able to get away with this. We don't. Like, if I sat at a dinner table with you, Anise, I'm like, so what do you earn a year? You'd be like, what? Why is that any of your business? Like,
oh, did you say we don't talk about money? Is that
we don't talk about money as British people.
I thought you said something else and I was like, huh?
Yeah. No, we don't. We don't talk about money. We don't talk about what people earn. And that's how companies get away with things. Because I think it was Insecure, but it happens in real life where Molly in Insecure found out that someone who worked in the same law firm, so she was a lawyer, and a male lawyer was getting more money than her, but doing the same job. And she only found out because she happened upon his wage slip. And my thing is, this thing happens all the time when we don't have open conversations about money. This is how brands are able to get away with things. And that's why the Instagram page is so important, because people have found a safe space to talk about money. Because not everyone is going to be like that Instagram you mentioned, Luanda, who's going to be on the photo shoot and say, how much are you earning for this? And we need to be more upfront about it so that they can't take advice. There needs to be true allyship. And something that Chadwick Boseman did that was amazing, I don't know if you guys saw it, with Sienna Miller.
I did.
And she was saying that she asked for money on the film 21 Bridges and they said, we can't pay it. And she said she's refusing now to accept money that is below her worth. And he says, you shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And then he took some of his money and gave it to her and said, I will top up to what it is that you want because I want you on this film. And we need to have allyship in influencers as well, to say that actually I'm going to reveal what I'm getting and not just
that's what I'm talking about,
so I'm the only person catching the bag out here and everyone can be fair for everyone, because influencing is hard work. We are all women who are creative. We have Instagram accounts. It is not easy to kind of keep your feed up, to keep posting, to get the right light, to get the right video, to edit. It all takes money. And I think sometimes they are not paying because they don't realize that you are taking time out of people's work. And if you're not paying them as an influencer, you don't have sick pay. You don't have holiday pay. No. You don't have pension pay. Like, whatever you want to give me for free ain't paying my bills. So there needs to be respect for what the work that people are doing and recognize it as hard work.
Yeah, definitely. Someone was offered wine and cheese for some content.
Girl, I saw that. I was just like, what? Like,
did you see the post when they said, does anyone know a bank that accepts wine and cheese?
I did not see that. LOL, that is crazy. No, wine and cheese, you know? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. You know, this kind of happened to me one time. I was on set. You know what? Let me not tell this story. I'll tell you guys after we finish.
No, we want this story. You better
tell it.
I'll tell it really quickly. So no, I'm not going to get in trouble. I'll be fine. We were on set and we actually just had a conversation with each other and we ended up on the topic of money. And then we realized that some people weren't getting paid the agreed amount. And it was because, you know, actors can come from different avenues. You might have an actor off like a website where they have their headshot and their CV. You might have an actor from an agent. You might have an actor from someone that you know. And they were able to kind of do a little sneaky situation. But then when we would, because we would just got along really well and we talked about it. And then when we brought up the issue, they were almost mad. No, not almost mad. They were mad that we discussed money. They were like, well, why are the actors talking? We're on set for at least 12 hours together. What else do you think we're going to do?
What else is going
to
happen?
This is my point. They feed off people staying silent. So we need to be honest. And Anissa, please tell
people us
how like
much to be
you
sneaky.
Earn
here. Yeah. People like to be sneaky.
For sure. For sure. So whilst influencers stay successful because social media users see them as life goals, a recent BBC article has suggested that we stop making goals altogether. The article suggests that we can't fully enjoy life if we're always focused on achieving a goal, and that we're also setting ourselves up for failure if we're not successful in what we set our minds to. In addition to that, they say that a lot of people have the goal to be happy, but being happy involves gratitude and focusing on your family when most of us are focusing on our careers and our material things. Do you set goals? And if you set goals, do you think they are personal to your ambitions, or do you think that society has affected what you think you should be achieving? And do you think that you can be fully present in life if you're fixated on certain outcomes?
Wow. That was like a big dump. I'm like thinking, like, oh, okay.
She wants a lot of answers.
Yeah, a lot of answers. Do I set goals? I would say that I am sometime-ish about setting goals. In the word, in the way of basically saying it is, I may set a goal, but it's not hard and fast and fixed. It's something that's quite loose. And I know when you're setting goals, the more specific, the better it is, because the more like you're going to achieve it and all that kind of fun stuff. But the reason why I kind of keep my goals loose and I really try not to set goals is because it's kind of like what you asked in your question, Amanda. I just want to be present in all the moments that I'm in. And so I don't want to feel like the pressure of thinking I've got to achieve this, I've got to achieve this, I've got to achieve this. So I like to just keep things open and loose. Now, with that being
you heard it here first, guys, Anissa keeps it loose.
Just life, you know, just life. Nothing else. And so I just try to stay open to what life has for me, because I think there have been times, I think maybe when I was younger, I'd set goals, and I'm not talking like really like life-changing goals, but I may have set smaller goals, and sometimes I would have achieved them, sometimes I didn't. But when I didn't achieve them, I'd feel so disappointed in myself. Like, it would just weigh me down like a ton of bricks, and I couldn't see past what I didn't achieve, and I couldn't see all the other good things I'd done in my life, or what me failing in that goal, the goodness that it still brought in my life. I couldn't see that, because the only thing I could see was what I failed in. So it was so after that, I kind of just decided to take that out of my life and just stay open. Say, you know what? I would love to do that one day. If it doesn't happen, then I'm happy for whatever God still has in store for me. But I just want to stay open. And that's kind of how I live mine.
Nice.
Sorry, that was like a tangent.
No.
I think for me, I don't think I really started to really set goals until the past few years. Like, I had kind of general things, and I think in terms of what Luanda was saying, I think it's really difficult to set the goals that you want to set without family expectation, society expectation, all these other things that will influence you. Because I would say for me, like, my parents had goals for me, and they weren't bad goals. Like, they wanted me to go to university. Like, in church, they were kind of, in my faith, there is an expectation or a goal to be a certain type of person, someone who lives with love and integrity. But then sometimes there can be the flip side of that, in terms of, whereas my parents' goal was for me to go to university, it also was like there were certain subjects that they didn't want me to study, and those were some of the subjects that I wanted to study. And in terms of church as well, there's an expectation that people expect you to get married at a certain age. And sometimes it's only as I've gotten older that I've had to start working out not just what goals that I want for my life, but what are the ones that actually call to my purpose and what I want to do and what I have an interest in. So I think for me, it was very much about trying to listen to my own inner voice and pray about what do I actually, what does Sophie want to do? Not everyone else, not what society's telling me. What do I want to do? And I really hope that people can get to the core of that, because I think it's so easy for a goal to be to, you know, have a 5-bedroom house and blah, blah, blah. But how do you get there? Like, what do you actually want to accomplish? Do you want to do something positive in the world, or do you just want to have lots of things?
Yeah, yeah. I think I've actually found what works for me. I think I believe in setting intentions, but I also believe in being present as well. And I feel that, because I've always been a goal setter, it's just been, I like lists. So and I've always made goals. But over the past couple of years, I've changed my goals, because I realized that they were quite spiritually empty. And I realized that
what were the goals before, Luanda?
Yeah.
If you don't mind, like clearing ones, you can give us an example.
So I think sometimes there would be things that were out of my control. Like, for example, if you want a certain job, you can do all the necessary steps, but you still might not get that job. But it doesn't mean, like I said, like Anissa said, oh, you feel that weight of disappointment. It doesn't mean that you've done anything wrong. Or sometimes we plan the things that make sense for us, but the universe has a different idea. And it's always a better option. So I think sometimes I would be fixated on, oh, I need this, 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 and this. Because I used to get so pressed on age. And I know that this is something that affects everyone, but it just affects women on a different level. Yeah. Right?
I feel you, Levanta. I'm feeling you, girl.
And so this is why I'm always on your neck, Anissa. I'm always pressed. When you're saying that you're old, like, I'm always pressed. And this is why, because I had like a transitional period, and I'm so glad that I went through it, because I was genuinely so impatient to achieve the goals that I had planned to achieve by a certain age. And then I transitioned from having the mindset of feeling like I was running out of time to now feeling like, we just started the clock. There's way more ahead of me than there is behind me. And so we all have so much time. And so there's no need to think like, oh, I haven't done this by 18. I haven't done this by 20. I haven't done this by... It's ridiculous, because we have so much life to live and we shouldn't be focused on anyone else's journey except our own. And so now, instead of making the goals that I said before that were quite empty, I now concentrate on personal growth. And I think when you're thinking about ways that you can positively improve yourself, everything around you is going to be a positive improvement as well. And I've enjoyed life a lot more. I've experienced like a level of patience that I've never had in my life, and perspective that I've never had, from having this new mindset and from just controlling only the things that I control, which is myself, and working on myself, making smart decisions for who I am. And like you said, Sophie, what aligns with your purpose, instead of thinking on the more, you know, materialistic end of, I feel like all of my goals, which are just to do with acting before. And now, you know, I want to learn new languages. I want to be more intelligent. I could go on.
But to pick up on the age thing, Luanda, because obviously me and you are always going back and forth about the perception of our age.
Oh, and you're both in your 20s. It's a joke.
Honestly, the perception of our age, and I say our age, since me and Luanda loves to kindly remind us of me that we are the same age.
We're close enough.
We perceive it in two different ways. The perception of our age is kind of the reason how I landed up about the trying to be loose with goals, because it's almost as well as what you were saying, Sophie, about society. It's just like, okay, so you think by a certain age you should have achieved X, Y, and Z, and when you don't, it's like, oh my gosh, like, what am I doing? And sometimes I do feel like an intense pressure to be like, I don't have that much time. And though, even though I know I have so much time ahead of me, the time I have ahead of me still has a bit of an asterisk on it, because when I'm thinking about it, it's like, okay, if I get married and, you know, he wants me to lay down and have a child for him or whatever, that's going to take X amount of time away from me achieving the goals that I want, because maybe I might be achieving another goal of motherhood. But say, for example, my goal wasn't motherhood, it was something else. I've now got to take time out of that goal to do the motherhood thing for at least 9 months, because I'll be physically unable to chase my goals. So now that I'm at my age or our age, I am fully conscious of if I don't do something by a certain period of time, that then I fall into a relationship and this person wants a baby, but I haven't achieved what I wanted to do before I had a baby, I'm going to be at a bit of a crossroad, and unfortunately biology might not wait for me to achieve that goal. So I'm constantly in that kind of hamster wheel of, oh God, well, I've got to make sure I do everything I want to do before I even have to sit down in that predicament and think, rah, am I going to stop fighting for my goals so I can have this baby? Or like, I don't want to have to pick between my goal and a baby. Does that make sense? So that's why I feel like I'm always pressured to like get these goals done now.
I think as women, like, we definitely have to, we've talked about this on the show about,
yeah,
with women, there is that decision that we have to make in terms of carrying a child. And I wouldn't even say, I don't even think your life really has to stop when you're pregnant, unless you have a terrible pregnancy. But in general, it's a bit afterwards, Lord, when they're literally this young child
that newborn
solely depends on you. They cannot do, they can't do anything. And it's about, yeah, I think that's why when we talk about goals, I think it was an article in BBC when it was talking about to focus on the process rather than the outcome. Because like when we focus on outcomes, like, you know, then what we do is we work so hard to get the outcome that we miss all the things along the way that we could have been enjoying, all the things that could have taken us on a different path to where we want to get to. But we were like, no, it has to be this way because I've done my 10-step plan and that doesn't fit into it. And I feel sometimes it can be about having a sense of control. Like if I have the plan and I follow the plan, then I can control what my outcome is. But as Luanda says, life will show you that we have no control over anything. So we have to try and enjoy the process of getting to where we're going to, but then also not hold it too tightly that if it changes, then, you know, we feel like, oh, my life is over. But I think it's really difficult, because I'm not saying I'm against goals, because goals do help towards things. Like they help you to stay focused, and they help you to not be deterred by other things. And you're kind of like, this is one, if I want to save £10,000 this year, then I need to know there's certain things that I can't do because I have that goal. But if I spend like £500 on getting something fixed, I'm not going to beat myself up if I only raise 8,500, because the goal isn't there to be the only indicator of success. And I think that's where we have an issue in society, that the outcome is a success and anything else was just a waste of time if we don't reach it.
Yeah, I feel that. I feel like being receptive and being present is one of the most significant and important things that we can do as people. Because, you know, we keep talking about young people growing up and then being different people. Sometimes we just keep the same goals that we had when we were eight and we don't change them. Even though we, as people, have changed. And we need to continuously reassess our journey, especially as creatives, because this took me a really long time. But I've always been an actress, and it took me a really long time to accept myself as other subgenres of creative, because, you know, I now when someone asks me what I do, I say I'm a creative. I don't even say I'm an actress anymore. Like, I will say, oh, I'm a creative, you know, that performs or that writes and that does this, and I will get specific if they ask me. But because I don't ever want to box myself like the way that I was before, like I was solely focused on I'm going down one lane and one lane only, and I'm not, you know, we're not stopping for gas. We're not eating a sandwich. We're going in that direction. Yeah. And I think, you know, for a period of time, it was positive because it helped me get to the stage that I am now. But at the same time, like, my life is not over, and there's so much more that I want to do, and there's so much more that I want to learn. And so I think that we just need to be open to different directions and different doors opening for us, even if it's not the ones that we planned in our head. Because like we said, we don't have control over the way that it's going to map out. The only thing that we can control is the way that we react to the circumstances and the people in our lives. And so if we concentrate on how we're treating ourselves, then I think we're good.
And I think I just wanted to add on to that in terms of goals and setting, is that I read this thing on Instagram, like this guy and I posted it, and he was talking about the 7 things that people regret at the end of their life. And none of them had to do with, you know, having a bigger house or having more success. They were like, you know, not traveling more to see the world, not leaving that job to pursue my dreams, not spending more time with family, letting relationships fall by the wayside, like not not putting my happiness first and trying to pursue the things or living a life that was true to myself. These are the things that people regret. And I think it's so interesting that the world just goes round in cycles and cycles and cycles. And we constantly see that happiness or a fulfilled life is not achieved through things. But yet society still pushes that, when really the things that people, that make people happy, are connectedness and being with other people and feeling love. So, like, just, yeah, your goals should be leading you towards the things that really matter in life.
For sure, for sure.
I totally agree. I blame capitalism. Yeah.
I was like, let me not get in a capitalist rant right now. It's not the time.
We're going to put a pin in it right there.
But I think both of you summed it up well said. Like, whether you want to set a goal or you don't set goals in your life, I think the most important thing is just being present in the process and everything that is happening right now. But we want to thank you so much for watching and listening to another episode of Ethnically Speaking. We've enjoyed every minute of it. And if you have too, don't forget to give us a thumbs up. Let's keep the conversation going. Are you a goal setter? Do you feel like society is putting pressure on you to achieve certain goals? Let us know in the comments below. And if you want even more from us, then don't be sure to subscribe to our email list for access to Extra Ethnic, which is a special segment for our most Ride or Die fans. And that's available exclusively via email. There's a link to sign up in the description below. And for a summary of everything we've discussed today, make sure you head over to unitedmelaningroup.com/ES017. There's a link in the description for that as well. And if you're watching on YouTube, don't forget to subscribe and hit that notification bell so you don't miss a thing. We'll see you the same time next week. Stay safe and stay alert.